I was talking to a generative AI architect, and he was talking about buildings being grown, not built.
Oh, very much, yes.
And this idea that you program these materials like mycelium, for example, and you plant it, and then you come back a year later, and it's grown into this building extremely cheaply and in a way that's much more like more efficient and more happiness inducing for humans who really only live in big square blocks because it's economically efficient. Hello and welcome to Crazy Until It's Not, a podcast about big ideas and the amazing people behind them. Every episode, we bring on a new guest who has a prediction for the future, which on the face of it sounds a little bit crazy. I'm your host, Michael Stothart, an early stage tech investor at First Minute Capital. And today I'm joined by Steph Van Grieken, the founder of Cradle, which is an extremely exciting company, which is helping scientists design better proteins in record time with generative AI. Steph, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So could you start, before we go into what is Cradle and indeed what is a protein, because I don't think everyone knows that. Can you just tell us a little bit about you, your background, Google research, just like what you did before Cradle and how you got into it, really?
Yeah, certainly. So I'm not a biologist. I'm a computer scientist by training. And so before starting Cradle, I was on the product leadership team of Google Research and Machine Intelligence, where we were doing a lot of ML research, and probably the T in GPT, the transformer, is a quite popular model that came out of that group. And so saw some of the really amazing research as well as the application of these types of techniques in Google products, ranging from translation to Google search to YouTube. Sort of straddling the halls of Google research, I ran into my now co-founder, Eli Bixby, who was applying this stuff to biology. And initially, my first response probably is, some of your listeners is also like, why the heck would you want to use transformers in biology? And he said, you can think of DNA as this like cool alien programming language that we have, but it evolved and it was never really designed to be engineered. But maybe similarly to how we've learned natural language, like human language, we might be able to learn how to engineer organic chemistry. And so really that blew my mind, because all of the things, or most of the things around us are biology, like including ourselves here. And so if you could tweak that or engineer that, that could open up a really exciting future.
The time then, did it feel real or did that seem insane? Because obviously that's not really what transformers, that's not the most obvious use case for how transformers, or indeed sort of the bulk of generative AI now, is this ability to communicate with machines in natural language.
Certainly.
And this, the decoding of an alien language, is when you put it like that, I guess is a bit similar, but isn't the most obvious use case. So like, how did it feel at the time? Like, did it feel crazy or did it feel like just the right thing?
Somewhat. Many people in the venture community thought it was crazy for sure.
Can you just do a marketing tool for A/B testing marketing, please? We will give you
I mean, we pitched this company before Gen AI was even a thing, right? Like GPT wasn't out yet. Even AlphaFold 2 wasn't out yet at the time. And so the whole notion that you could use these types of techniques more broadly into domains like biology was at least not well recognized in the venture community. That said, there was a bunch of evidence that these methods generalize pretty well, like language translation, language summarization, also for non-formal human languages. Like we saw examples of, can these things write code and can they be applied to sort of other domains? And so there was some evidence that this would work. Obviously, I was aware of some of the stuff that was happening at DeepMind at the time with AlphaFold. And so this felt like a worthwhile thing to spend some time on. And so really, like, the first year and a half for us was also about, does this even work and is it better than what people do today? The bet was it's a sequence-to-sequence problem, very similar to translation, and so maybe we can solve it.
Did you have imposter syndrome back then. I've seen the maps of how, like, what is happening chemically in molecules, and I'm sure you've seen these, of like 800,000 diodes crossing in a million different ways, and it's just infinitesimally complicated. When you thought, right, I'm going to go out to in some way solve a bit of this, did you feel imposter syndrome? Did you feel a sense of panic when you were going about it?
Certainly, yeah. No, I mean, you start with very abstract notions, obviously. Like, you have approximate knowledge of many things. And then you start interviewing people, for example. Like, I spoke to about 100 biologists to learn a little bit more about their domain. And I think very quickly I realized, for example, organisms are way too complicated. Cells really are still way too complicated. But proteins are sort of maybe small enough and contained enough that we might be able to do something at that level. And you really need to scope it down to, you know, the simplest thing that you can still solve, that is still, you know, expansive enough that there is a good market there. Right?
So this is a great segue into what is CRADL? What are you actually doing? Because a lot of our listeners will have no idea. And could you actually just start, you mentioned proteins, and we'll talk about proteins. Can you just tell us, what is a protein?
Yeah, certainly.
Why did you choose proteins as well? But maybe just what is a protein? Like, what does it do? Give me some examples.
Yeah, certainly. So most organisms are made out of multiple cells. And they're, you know, the little machines inside of an organism. And then proteins are the little machines inside the cells. And so they might be responsible to move oxygen into the cell. They might be responsible to catalyze certain chemical reactions in the cell. They might be involved with, like, reading and writing DNA in the cell. And so there's, like, very, like, you know, tens of thousands of different proteins at work in any type of cell.
And what's the machine inside the protein?
Well, proteins get encoded in DNA. And so when they get executed, they turn into RNA, which is a long string of beads, effectively. And then these beads get folded into a little bit of a squiggly, which is a protein. And then the protein has a certain biological function, like the ones that I was just describing. Some might become a cell wall. Some might, you know, catalyze a certain reaction. You know, some might have some signaling value, and they might trigger a certain other reaction within the cell. But they can do very many different things.
So the machine within a protein is the DNA, essentially.
I wouldn't say it's the machine within it, but it's the smallest unit, let's say, of biology that we have that we can still reasonably engineer.
Great. So, what do you guys do? How are people using proteins now, and how does CRADL make the process of discovering new proteins or use cases for proteins? Mm-hmm. Better.
Yeah. So proteins are actually in quite many different products already today. And so about, for example, half of the medicines that we make are protein-based. But there's more, you know, weirder stuff. Like, you might have at some point wondered, why do my detergents keep working at lower temperatures? That's because we started to formulate enzymes into them, and enzymes can break down fats really well, much better than certain chemicals can. And so the share of biological stuff in your detergents has gone up. You know, you might enjoy cheese. I'm a Dutchman. I enjoy cheese a lot. You know, cheese gets made with an enzyme, and different cheeses, you know, get made through different types of enzymes. And so, you know, really very many things have proteins at their core already today, but increasingly, you know, we want to make more use of them on the human health side, because we want to cure more disease faster. And then on the planetary health side, you know, we're currently using a lot of oil, and we're using a lot of animals to manufacture our things, whereas you could also be using biology a lot more for our chemicals, for our materials, for our foods. And so what does CRADL do? We help the research and development teams effectively engineer these proteins. Now, what does that mean, engineer a protein? Let's say you want to break down fat in a detergent. You know, as a biologist, you might want to engineer things like, can that go faster, right? Because we want to be able to run shorter cycles. Like, a biologist would call that the activity of the protein. How active is it? You know, you might want to make sure that it runs more efficiently at a lower temperature. They call that temperature stability. And so, you know, that's something you might want to engineer. Or in your factory, you might want to make more of that enzyme, which means the cell needs to make more of it. They call that expression. Like, maybe I can get more of it to be made. And so these are typically things that you can engineer. The way that you do that is by changing the DNA of the protein. And so really what CRADL does, akin to something like ChatGPT, where you ask it a question with a prompt and you get an answer, or in the case of something like Stable Diffusion, you give it a description of the image you want and it generates an image. In our case, you tell it, this is the thing I have today, like this enzyme, make it go faster, make it be more stable, and you know, whatever the design objectives are, and it will generate a set of sequences you can put into your experiments that have a much higher probability of meeting your engineering objectives.
So is that, where's the line between optimizing the experiment process, which is, I believe what you were saying, is the kind of main use case of CRADL, and making that faster and more efficient, and like true creativity in what enzymes and proteins are and what they might possibly be able to do. From like, this is a whole new protein that you hadn't even thought about that you could make, and or this protein that you've been using for this for centuries, for making cheese for centuries, would be much better, repairing concrete, you know, with this tiny tweak.
Yeah, certainly.
Or for whatever it is. Like, to what extent can it think out the box, or is that on a roadmap, or on a roadmap maybe of other companies in the space? Like, how, like, where are we with that?
No, I think that's a great question. So maybe to just answer the first part first, and then I'll dig into, like, can you come up with completely novel proteins this way? So if you're a bio team and you're trying to engineer one of these proteins, basically what your life looks like is you have a week of engineering the thing on your computer. They're currently might be using methods where they run a large simulation, or they might go into nature and figure out what nature has already tried, and they'll literally flip it. They'll make changes to the sequence. And then they try typically between 96 and 384 every experimental round. Then they'll buy the DNA. They'll make the protein. So they'll put it in a cell and express it. And then they'll run an experiment on it. Like, was it faster? Was it more stable? That kind of thing. That whole process is typically 8 to 12 weeks. And then the percentage of proteins that come back being better than the ones that they had before is between 1% to 5%. And so for a venture capitalist, that's not a very capital efficient way of getting to your objective. And so, and because typically it's not very hard to find a starting point in nature where some sort of chemistry gets catalyzed, or you know, some sort of medicine might be prevalent. The optimization is really where most of the money is being spent. So that's also why we're focusing on that. Then to your second question, which is, could you come up with new to nature proteins, right? And so that is a, like, that's currently the cutting edge of the research. They call this de novo protein generation. And there are actually some examples of this. So Baker Lab have shown a luciferase, which is a particular type of protein that was completely hallucinated by a machine learning model, and it was actually functional.
What did it do?
Yeah, they at that point, what you typically are trying to do. So let's say you're making an enzyme, which are the types of proteins that catalyze chemical reactions. Well, you then need to, and you can think of proteins or enzymes a little bit as sort of lock and key things. So they'll take in a molecule and they may break it apart into two ones, or they take different molecules and they'll glue them together, if you will. And so what they try to do, a little bit like how they do diffusion models, is they try to figure out what would be a shape that would sort of be amenable to making this chemical reaction happen. And they try to hallucinate a structure around it. And actually that worked. That is still very early stage work. It's very hard to give, you know, we can't be like, I have an arbitrary chemical reaction, sort of generate me some biology for this arbitrary chemical reaction. I do think we will get there in the not too far future. So that is a frontier right now.
What did that do though? What did that chemical, sorry, what did that protein do? Did it do anything, or was it just amazing that it was new?
It was a luciferase. And I think a luciferase is involved in gene expression. I am not a biologist on the team. I'm the computer scientist. But I'm happy to send you the paper for the show notes.
I wouldn't understand it. So,
but it was a novelly generated protein that had a biological function that is known that wasn't existing in nature before. And so that was quite cool and unique.
That is super, super cool. I want to talk more about the utopian future that might be in front of us. But maybe we could just pause here for a second to ask you about your big crazy idea. Your idea for the future, your prediction for the future, which on the face of it sounds a little bit crazy, but actually you're going to tell us why it's not so crazy after all.
Yeah, I mean, I think engineered biology is going to be everywhere. And so we're really in the first act of that, which means that we're replacing existing products today, like drugs that are antibodies, and we sort of change them a little bit to do something else, like detect cancer, and then you can cure cancer that way, or foods that are made in fermenters like milk or some of the alternative protein meats that we have there. I think the second act, and we're starting to see some of the early signs of that, is where we start to build entirely new products that don't exist today that are made with biology. And so to give you some examples, there's a real cool company in France. They're called Neoplants. They have effectively engineered a plant to be an air filter. And so it's like much better at absorbing all kinds of volatiles in your living room, up to a point where it's now as good as an air filter, which is pretty cool. Right? But you can think of things like fabrics that are being made with biology. Like, biology is very good. Like, sharks have really cool skin, for example, or spiders have really cool silk. Like, we still haven't made synthetic fiber that is as strong as spider silk, for example. And so you could imagine clothing that is like super light, but super strong and super durable. There's a couple of companies out there that are working on, data storage in DNA. And so hard disks made out of biology. Why? Because you can store a lot of information in DNA, way more than you can on conventional computers. Compute in DNA, like, we can do math. Like, our brains right now are still kicking GPT's ass, and we run on a very small battery, right? We don't need a data center to have this conversation, right? personalized drugs, those types of things. And I think the step beyond that, which is far out still, but I think you can start seeing the first signs of that, is improving existing organisms this way. And so, humans starting to augment themselves, I think in 20 to 30 years from now, could be possible. And what could be these augmentations? You have the whole sort of life extension biology crew that's trying to figure out, like, how do we age, and can we reverse these processes? And give you a current example, there's some really cool paper coming out of Cambridge where, like, if you're a plant and you get into a prolonged period of drought, there's actually a stress response that kicks in, and it changes the genome of the plant to be much more resistant to future events of drought. And so these people build a gene therapy, which is a protein-based therapy, that you can effectively use to knock out the set of genes that get triggered when a drought event happens before an actual drought happens, which is pretty cool. So you can build more drought-resistant plants basically by giving them drugs. there's like many different ways in which you could, in theory, improve a human, right? Like, I would love to have a little bit more hair, for example.
I'd love to talk about the material side. I mean, I'd love to talk about lots of different elements to this. And actually, maybe a good starting point is, like, where do you see the sequence of which of these dominoes fall first, from augmented humans with extra arms and living forever, maybe on the further outside.
That is definitely act three, yes.
And
I mean, some of this we're already doing, right? We have gene-based therapies where we are changing genetic defects. Those are very small changes, but we are already applying this for disease domains.
Yeah. So what what happens first to our listeners now in the next 5 years? What do you think is going to be the coolest thing that will impact them, that could touch them?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the reasons why we're not seeing more of this is because it's very expensive to do the research and development for these types of products, right? So if you're making a protein-based drug, it's easily $600 million before you can go into clinical trials, which is another $600 million, right? And so I think the first thing that will start, if let's say these types of techniques in Gen AI can cut that in half, then suddenly as a pharma company, you can have twice the amount of drugs in your pipeline as you're developing them. So that's super cool. I think similarly for these other products like chemicals or foods or, you know, these types of things that you could build with biology, let's say instead of, you know, today it's around $20 to $40 million, that becomes like a $4 to $5 million thing, then you're going to be investing in a lot of bugs, right? because that suddenly fits within a fund horizon. You know, it's something where you can spread risk and you get an answer reasonably fast, right? And so I think this is going to be nonlinear, like how, you know, I was at Google in the early days of TensorFlow, and one of the questions we asked ourselves, like, how many people are actually going to make a machine learning model? We had no idea, right? I think the answer at this point is very many, probably, right? And so I think very similarly, because those capabilities become a lot more accessible in biology, you'll start seeing a lot more companies building a lot more things and building them in a shorter amount of time for a lower amount of capital. So what we'll see first, I think, you know, the most valued proteins, like, nature doesn't care, right? But the most valued proteins are things that cure humans, for example. So I think you'll see a lot more drugs being developed with help from these types of techniques. And I think increasingly you'll see like high value chemicals, you'll see certain high value foods, those types of products being introduced into the market. And then obviously, you know, fully bio-based computers, that will take a little longer because it's a lot more complicated product to build. But yeah, we're at that first moment where, you know, I still remember my dad giving me a dial-up modem. You know, I can reach people in America from the Netherlands, right? That was like, right. I think we're sort of in that stage when it comes to engineering biology. But, you know, we're not even that far away from when I got my first modem, and I could have never imagined GPT, right?
Materials like mycelium, for example, and you plant it, and then you come back a year later, and it's grown into this building extremely cheaply and in a way that's much more, like, more efficient and more happiness inducing for humans who really only live in big square blocks because it's economically efficient. But actually swirling organic shapes might be, you know, a much more aesthetically pleasing thing. But I love the idea of, you know, the organic hard drive as well, this sort of soup, primordial soup being your hard drive.
No, definitely. And I mean, I think what's important to recognize is we've done something quite weird, which is with petrochemicals, we've started to drill into the earth to the deepest cores that we can find, right? And getting hydrocarbons out of that hole. And then we turn it into materials and those types of things. And that is the longest cycle in the planet, right? Where the very short cycles are, you know, we eat sugars, water, we absorb CO2, right, in the case of plants and that kind of thing. And then we are our biological selves, right? And if you look at a plant, it's kind of cool that only a handful of C's, T's, A's, and G's, well, not a handful, but yeah, a couple hundred thousand can, like, produce that complexity out of literally thin air and a bit of water, right? and so I think a lot of these techniques where you would make products that humans use using those types of inputs is a lot closer to home, right? Because there's sugar everywhere. There's water everywhere. These are earth abundant materials, right? Why? Because we evolved in them, right? And so if you look at, for example, a really great company in the US called Solugen, they're making like precision chemicals, but they don't do it by, you know, using hydrocarbons. they do it through biology, through enzymes that sort of do a reaction. And what goes into that factory, and it's a chemical scale facility, water, sugar, and CO2. There's no heat, no carcinogenics, no toxins, nothing. And it produces products we can use cheaper than with the chemical, like the petrol alternative. That's a really cool future, right? Because where do you get sugar? Well, it's whatever you put in your green bin, that's sugar, right? You shred it and you have sugar, right? And so, you know, it's a pretty cool world where all of these things are local circular chains, right? Instead of having to bring everything from everywhere in the world or dig it up from the ground.
When you're digging into these chains and this universe, this alien language, as you really nicely put it at the beginning, are you in awe of its efficiency and of its brilliance, or are you just like stunned by the redundancy and over engineeringness of it, or a mixture of the two and slightly baffled? It feels like contact with an alien race, and maybe it's better, maybe it's worse. Like, how does that contact feel, I suppose, when you're...
I mean, I'm still in my honeymoon phase with biology, certainly. And so my bio co-founder is like, duh, of course. But, you know, like for your audience, like look up kinesine, K-I-N-E-S-I-N on Google. And these are the garbage disposal proteins. They're literally motor proteins. So that means they can walk. And there's these long sort of strands that are inside your cell, and they like attach to stuff that needs to be brought to the cell wall. And they are literally, you know, walking, right? Or, you know, the core protein that's involved with energy use within your body is called ATP synthase. So it literally makes the little, you know, like chunks of molecules that other parts of the cell need in order to have energy. You know, that thing that turns around, it's almost like an engine. And it runs at over 100 hertz, which is like insane, right? And that just evolves, right? Anyway, and so yeah, I'm still like wildly excited about all the things that biology can already do, let alone the things you could be doing with it in the future, right? And there's researchers that have tried to estimate it, where they think like maybe 1% of what could be possible has been explored by evolution, because like a lot of things, there's no real evolutionary reason to have them, right? But we might be able to build with them, right?
Do you have a sense that it resists programming? That the idea of programming is fundamentally a kind of computorial, mathematical concept, and biology is somehow resistant to that, wants to throw off that archetype?
I mean, certainly, right? It was never designed to do that, right? Like anything that we engineered as humans, we can decompose into small bits because we had to assemble it at some point, right? And that's not how biology came about, right? There wasn't like somebody that dropped BioPython in the world, and there's a compiler that's fully understood, and you know that kind of, that's not like we're discovering biology and how it works all the time. And there's been, you know, a tremendous amount of things that we've learned, you know, even in the last century, right? And you know, it's one of the reasons why we started with proteins. Proteins are very small, right? They're like a few hundred amino acids, whereas organisms are like millions. And the complexity and all of the interactions between parts of that sort of source code are very hard to understand. I see it more as a discovery process than anything else, like how maybe, you know, folks in ancient Egypt tried to decipher the hieroglyphs. And that they had the benefit of that being an actual human language. it's really about like learning life's languages. And we're only at the very early beginnings of it. And we still very poorly understand it.
Are there no-go areas for you guys? I mean, it feels like, I don't know if these are premature questions in a world where we're at the foothills of, you know, with the equivalent of rubbing sticks together to make fire versus inventing the atom bomb. But still, is that something on your mind? Do you think about that? Do you think about the like ethics in this space, and how do you approach it now?
No, certainly. And so, luckily proteins don't self-propagate. So it's a little harder, you know, the sort of like with AI, the fear is they'll get out there and kill us all. Right. You know, with biology, that's always also a fear. We are still at such a small level that it's like, proteins don't self-replicate, for example. That said, there are definitely ways in which you can engineer proteins to do things that we might not want. And for example, we had to write a terms of service. And so, you know, we had to make a list of things that you cannot do with it. And so, So, for example, we don't want people to try and encode a toxin that originates from a plant or some other pathogen. We try to make sure that people don't try to encode an infectious form of a virus. You know, we don't want people to engineer anything that can self-replicate. We don't want to interfere with cloning or encode for like an entological agent. So, yeah. And I think we have a sort of catch-all in there somewhere of like, and just think, right?
Be cool. Okay.
Yeah. Don't go against the, yeah. But that's an important one. I think the second thing is we vet every customer that we work with before they get access to the platform. And so if you're like a large, well-known pharma company or a large known chemical company, you know, we get to trust you. Cradle is not a developer tool you get to use in your bathtub, right?
but I was going to ask about that, which is if the cost of developing a new protein is $600 million today before you even go to clinical trials, as in outrageously expensive. If that halves, that's great for humanity. But isn't it also great, and are we possibly heading to a world where indie hacker teams can experiment with building awesome proteins and awesome stuff? And maybe that's a world that we do want to live in. And maybe it's not two people in your bathtub, but maybe it's a team of seven scientists that get backing from a seed fund like First Minute, where suddenly the capital, it makes sense for them to give something a go. Is that a world that's ever likely, that makes sense? I mean, maybe we don't want to live in that world even, but like, what do you think?
No. I think it certainly is. It's not a problem for us right now, but it will be a problem as we scale. You know, some of that indie hacking happens in universities. And so you can definitely trust most university teams with this type of stuff. You know, there's abuse controls that we could build, like, this looks very much like a toxin, Steve. And we had an agreement on toxins, right? So, you know, there's those types of things that you can do. But like with every technology, you know, you can use AI to guide bombs into better places, or you can use it to diagnose patients, right? And so it's ultimately up to us to both determine what we're okay with and not, and then to make sure that we enforce that in a reasonable way.
But even aside from the ethics, just for it to be possible to design proteins new or optimized with a team of seven rather than a team of, I don't know how big a drug company team is working on these things, but presumably hundreds. Like how far are we away from it being a kind of startup endeavor?
I mean, I think we're at a point already where it's a startup endeavor, because obviously biotech companies get funded all the time. And there's a whole class of venture capitalists that sort of know how to do the, you know, if one survives and we make a few billion dollars, then, you know, like in biotech investing, fund returner means a very different thing, right? And so that already happens. I do think from a portfolio perspective, the probability that you're going to have success goes up. And if the capital requirement to deploy, you know, you could suddenly do, you know, like I don't think we're going to get to spray and pray very soon, but you could dramatically get to milestones dramatically faster than what you could do today, and that's ultimately just good for the industry, right? And, you know, maybe it's going to, if cost comes down, maybe cost of actual medication comes down as well. The percentage of things that we can cure goes down. And so sort of both suffering in term, and health costs come down. And so there's like all kinds of knock-on effects that we can't really estimate right now. But at least my thesis is get cost of capital, or sorry, get cost of investment for R&D phase to come down as fast as possible. And then at some point, hopefully you can get to a world where five people can build a $1 billion drug in their basement with a computer, right? That'd be cool.
What I would like is one that was just proteins from natural language. So I'd like to be able to type in, I would like a protein that
I have an itch.
My hair purple, makes my hair purple today. Could you do that?
I mean, and we're decades away from that. And then from a safety perspective, like, I don't think any regulator would allow that. But,
I'm just saying that's what I'm ordering from you. If you could make that happen over the next several decades.
I think you should think about sort of large language models in biology as like GPT 0.1, right? We're definitely very far away from that kind of world. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, on that more sobering note to my ridiculousness, we've run out of time. But thank you so much for this honestly extremely entertaining discussion, and a really optimistic one about where we're going to be as long as I don't have my way and people like you are in charge. We're entering a brave new world. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.